This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, we are stepping back a little bit, steeped in Arizona history. Going to look back 100 years or so of our history. We have two guests today. The first is a return guest on the Think Tank. Marshall Trimble is, I believe, official state historian, certainly unofficial, if not official. Troubadour teacher occasionally at Scottsdale Community College. And a quotation from him. He said, if Arizona had a Mount Rushmore, the men on it would be Carl Hayden, Ernest McFarland, Barry Goldwater, and John McCain. Our second guest ties very much into that. Gary Stewart is a recovering attorney, has just written a book about probably one of the people who may be less quick to come to mind, especially for newcomers to Arizona, but Ernest Mac McFarland was a giant of Arizona history. We will hear why in just a moment, but I want to, first of all, welcome you both to the show.
Good to be here.
And I thought the logical way to take this is chronologically. And if we go by that, Carl Hayden is dates back to the statehood era. I might add, he was the other famous Maricopa County sheriff.
Yes. Yeah.
So, Marshall, who is Carl Hayden?
Well, I was going to tell that story before. Probably it vaulted him into top runner when Arizona became a state. In 1910, the Woodson brothers robbed the train. We didn't have a main line in Phoenix at that time. And from Maricopa up to Phoenix, down by the Gila River, these two amateur boys, they called them the Beardless Boy Bandits. And they robbed the train, and just got some change out of it. And they were amateurs, and they headed for the Mexican border on horseback. But that didn't last long out in the desert.
Well, but what year is this?
In 1910.
Okay,
and just 2 years before statehood. So Sheriff Hayden went in pursuit of them, and it was the first time that a posse rode in a car. Bandits on horseback in a car, and he requisitioned a car down in Stanfield, I believe it was, a big old touring car, and had the posse in there with him, the rifles sticking up, and they went across the desert. No roads, dodging arroyos and cactus and everything else.
That's a rough ride.
It is, yeah.
Because I assume the terrain is about what it is now.
Pretty
save,
much,
save
yeah.
the roads.
Pretty much. And the boys had meanwhile, they had the desert had taken its toll on them, and they were sitting under a shade tree, and they thought this car coming were just mining speculators. And so one of them runs out and says, "Here we are. Hey, help, help." And Sheriff Hayden, of course, takes charge at this point, and he walks towards them. He has a pistol that's not loaded. He didn't really carry a pistol often, but he walks towards these boys, and he just stares them down, and one of them drops his gun, and the other one was afraid, was kind of hesitant, and Hayden just looked at him. He said, "Son, put that gun down," and he captured him, you might say, unarmed. Well, this got him a lot of publicity because, again, it was the first time a posse had ever chased outlaws in a car in America, and it was and Carl Hayden became a household name. This was a nationwide story, and so when Arizona became a state, but anyway, that was his role as sheriff. I could tell you lots of stories about Carl as a sheriff, but we probably have to talk on. We don't have that much time on him.
That is a great story, and my God, what bravado to walk up to a guy with a loaded gun when yours is not loaded.
He was a heck of a man. I'll tell you that. He was a good. What they used to say, Louis L'Amour says, "Good man to ride the river with."
No, it was the only one of the four I had not met at one point or another, and I remember him more from latter years. Mm-hmm. Because I remember watching Lyndon Johnson give the State of the Union address, and there are these two old duffers sitting behind him. Both looked about 100 years old. He was one of them. The other was McCormick from Massachusetts.
Yeah, he was vice, actually acting vice president for almost 2 years.
Johnson seceded to the presidency.
Yes, Johnson became president. Well, then he was acting vice president, and they didn't. He stayed in that position until Hubert Humphrey was named vice president, sworn in January of 1965.
And Carl Hayden's birthplace is now at the edge of the Rio Salado at Mill Avenue and Rio Salado Drive, the former Monty's restaurant. I see they're doing renovations in there.
Well, I hope they save it.
That's the deal with the developer is that they'll save it and preserve it, and you know they're doing. I walked by there; they're doing work in there, and it certainly along with the mill. They're going to save that.
Save the mill.
I don't understand the historical significance of the warehouse next to it. In that it is not, the mill itself is an architectural statement. The other one just looks to me like a warehouse of no particular architectural. But they're evidently going to save the whole thing.
Well, we lived at Tempe when I was born in 1939, and I can remember all that when Tempe was still a pretty small town.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary Stewart, you've just written a book on Call Me Mac about Ernest McFarland. Why don't we start with, did he intersect at all with Carl Hayden?
Oh, sure he did. Carl Hayden was a three-term senator by the time Mac decided to run. He actually made the decision in 1939 and announced it in 1940, which is consistent with today's politics.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most interesting things about the relationship between McFarland and Hayden is that in October of 1940, before the general election but after the primary, Mac took a trip back to Washington and spent a few days there, important days because he wasn't in Arizona running. But the reason for that trip was that Carl Hayden had offered to take Mac to meet President Eisenhower. I'm sorry, President
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, not Eisenhower. Eisenhower comes up.
He said 1940. That was a clue.
he comes up. He comes up a little later.
Yeah.
And in that meeting, they had the first three-way discussion between the president and what would soon become the two Arizona senators about the Central Arizona Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fairly long conversation. And Mac used that when he got back to Florence and started. And continued his campaign, then against Irv Jennings. He'd already defeated Ashurst in the primary.
Well, and the Central Arizona Project, I mean, without that, most of us wouldn't be here.
We would not.
So we'll be back. We'll pick up this discussion in just a moment in the think tank with our guest Gary Stewart, author of Call Me Mac, and Marshall Trimble, author of, you have a new book out as well.
It just came out a couple of weeks ago. It's called Arizona Oddities, a Land of Anomalies and Tamales.
Well, I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that as well when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
All right, we are talking to Marshall Trimble and Gary Stewart, who has written a book called Callin' Mac about Ernest McFarland. And you were talking about the first meeting when McFarland was introduced to President Roosevelt and discussed the Central Arizona Project back as early. I didn't know the discussions went as far back as 1940.
Yeah, October the 4th, 1940.
Wow.
Oh, it went back before that. It started in 1922.
Oh, really?
The project did.
Mm-hmm.
Actually digging or?
No.
The idea.
The idea. And Arizona wouldn't sign. Governor Hunt wouldn't sign. It was a Santa Fe compact. It was done in Santa Fe, and it included California, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada.
Uh-huh.
And but they didn't show the appropriation or what was allotting. California was going to get this much. Arizona was going to get. Later on, they worked that out, but Arizona wouldn't sign.
That was a legal case, right? California v. Arizona.
Oh, it went on from 1944. Arizona finally signed on. But it was not until 1963, because California, with its political clout, was able to delay and delay and delay. And so this was an issue dating way back to then when it first came up. And finally, they allotted us 2.8 million acre feet. And Nevada got 300,000 acre feet. And California got 4.4 million acre feet. So that's how it was divided up.
Isn't there also something in the deal for Central Arizona Project or the Colorado River Project that California gets, if there is a shortage, California gets theirs first? It's not just our percentage. It's what happens in a drought.
Yeah, that's what we had to agree to get it. And it finally passed in 1963, but it wasn't signed into law. We won the victory in 63 thanks to McFarland and Goldwater and Paul Fannin and the two Udall brothers, Mo Udall, Stu Udall. Interesting, there were six of them all together, and there were three Democrats and three Republicans.
Well, the Udall family, yeah, was always divided,
yeah.
Right?
Well, Stewart was Secretary of Interior.
Right. Under Kennedy.
And Mo took Stewart's old district here in Arizona.
Yep. And author of one of the better lines in politics. He's up in New Hampshire campaigning, and he walks into a barbershop, says, "Hi, I'm Mo Udall. I'm running for president." And they retort back to him is, "Yes, we were just laughing about that the other day."
Yeah. He was a funny guy, and he's a big 6'5", imposing, tall, lean figure, and one eye. He used to say, I'm a one-eyed Mormon, Democrat, and conservative Arizona. You can't find a bigger handicap than that.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually is a politician in Tennessee who wrote a book and stole a line I pointed out to him. I said, I read that, the barbershop line. I said, I've seen this before, a lot of years before. We're off track, but that's okay.
Mo was a great one, though.
We're talking about Ernest McFarland in early years. So he's elected first in 1940?
He was elected in 1940, joined the Senate, of course, in 1941. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the CAP— When Mack lost to Goldwater in 52, became the Arizona governor, while sitting as governor, he argued the Colorado River case before the United States Supreme Court. One of two lawyers, Mark Wilmer, was the other, but they argued the final case, the last argument before the Supreme Court on the CAP divide. That was a nice piece of history for Mack.
Yeah, Jack August, before he died, was in here talking about the Wilmer.
Yes.
Legacy and that intersection there.
And Mark Wilmer got a little bit more time at the oral argument than Mack got. Uh-huh. I remember that as a fact that Mack wasn't all that happy about.
So he's elected to the Senate and ultimately becomes majority leader.
Yes, he does.
And what was his notable accomplishments in that period as majority leader? We'll get the interesting replacement aspect of that later on.
He was holding the ship together as majority leader. The challenges, of course, was that the Korean War was raging, and there were a lot of problems going on in the country, and Eisenhower was getting ready. So it was a difficult time in the Senate.
When did he become majority leader?
In 1951, earlier in that year. And he did so for a reason that would seem quaint today. He was probably the most well-liked senator on both sides of the aisle. Mm-hmm. And that ability to cross the aisle and maintain close friendships, he and Bob Taft were very close personally and very opposed politically.
Robert Taft, known as Mr. Republican from Ohio.
Yeah. And so that was a fascinating time. It's a time when politicians read books. So we don't see enough of that today.
Mm-hmm. And they're too busy raising money.
Well, and that's another big thing. They didn't raise much money in Mack's run against Ashurst, for example, who was then a storage senator. He was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee at the time. He didn't campaign against Mack in the primary. He didn't think that a rural county judge had a chance of beating him. It turned out he beat him in 14 counties. But one of the things that happened that was so fascinating at that time was that Ashurst's total campaign expenses were just a little over $1,000 total, and he put up $412 himself because he didn't think there was going to be a campaign. He was waiting for the general. Meanwhile, Mack ran a campaign in 1940 that hasn't been run since. He went to 36 cities in 21 days before the general election, not counting the time that he went back to Washington to meet with the president. So that kind of shoe-leather politics. He went to barbershops and bars and cafes and restaurants, and they had rallies, but he didn't hold them. But he went to the rallies. They were called rodeos and dances in barns, and he covered everything individually and personally, and he licked most of the stamps on the 10,000 letters that he sent out.
Wow. Yeah, sounds like something from another era, because yeah, it was.
It was.
Before television.
Right, we will return with Gary Stewart and Marshall Trimble talking about giants of Arizona history in the Think Tank. We'll be back in just a moment.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are talking here with official state historian Marshall Trimble and author Gary Stewart, who has written a book, Call Him Mac, about Mack McFarland, one of the giants of Arizona history. The book, however, we've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves. The book is mostly about the young man, McFarland. Go back to the early part of the century, 1919. You pick it up. He's a young man in his 20s, and Arizona has really just become a state, and we're really frontier. Tell us about the period and the young man.
Well, the young man was an Oklahoma farm boy, and intended to stay in Oklahoma, but he went to college, got a degree from the University of Oklahoma, wanted to be a teacher, but that was 1919, and he joined the Navy, as did most of the people he knew well. They joined the Navy together. He went to boot camp, got in the hospital within a month, stayed in the hospital for a year with a very serious and was near death, on his deathbed literally several times. When he got out, finally after 330 days in the hospital, went back to his hometown, Ellsboro, Oklahoma, and made the decision then within a few months to move to Arizona. He had some respiratory problems. He had no money. When he arrived in Phoenix, Arizona.
That was back when you moved to Arizona for respiratory.
That's right.
Before we planted all this vegetation,
yeah.
We're no longer the haven for that.
So when he gets here, he doesn't stay long because what he intended to do was to go to law school anyhow. So he had a couple choices. He could go to Stanford or he could go to the U of A. He was living in Florence at the time. He was living in Casa Grande at the time, but later moved to Florence. He went to Stanford for the right reason. It was free.
Really?
So Stanford didn't charge for students at that point in time.
Really?
Yeah. So he didn't.
It wasn't a scholarship. It was free. A private institution, yeah, free tuition?
It was free tuition.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, that's for sure. But anyhow, the longer term is that while at Stanford, he got a master's degree in political science and a law degree, and combined those two. And unbeknownst to most people, except his family, of course, he always wanted to make a run in politics at a high level, at a serious level. He didn't want to start out as a member of the Arizona legislature, and that never occurred to him. But by the mid-30s, he had come on his second series of tragedies. His wife and his three children died in a 22-month period of time.
He's supporting himself practicing law, I assume, at this point?
He was at that point, yes. And so that second near-death event changed Mac, and he started to think about really big things like the United States Senate. And so the book is more about that time period because he wrote his own autobiography in 1979, and a fine historian, Jim McMullen, wrote a political biography about Mac in 2004. Mm-hmm. So those two books were in existence. And his family wanted to know a lot more about him as a young man. And they didn't know that. The grandchildren were born in the 50s and 60s. They knew him as a grandfather. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know much about that time period. So that's the book I wrote, was the Arizona years, most of them the early years.
Well, if we move on here now, I don't want to get, because this really, we think we've got nasty politics right now. 1952, Ernest McFarland is the majority leader, Democrat, in the United States Senate, and he's taken on by a Phoenix City councilman.
A young Phoenix City councilman with not much experience.
A Republican who later becomes somewhat famous. Either of you guys want to talk about that election?
Well, let me throw in on this on we didn't do on Mac. I think one of the most important things he did in Congress was he's one of the fathers of the GI Bill.
Absolutely.
Which was one of the most important pieces of legislation and profitable for the United States government to give education, college education to veterans.
We were generous to our World War II veterans, I think, in a way that we probably have not been generous to the veterans of almost any other of our wars. I mean, I know this vividly. My dad was a beneficiary of that, got sent through. He got 4 years of education, which in his case got him through to a master's degree because he accelerated a little bit. And I think the other lesson of that one was the real beneficiaries of that was the entire country, because we educated a generation, most of whom would never have seen college. And right after that, our economy took off.
And they got good jobs and paid a lot of taxes.
They paid a lot of taxes, more than, as we know now from economic studies, if you send somebody, in rough terms, the college-educated folks in this country pay more in taxes than they get in services, and that divides. Sub-college, the reverse is true. In other words, for the nation as a whole, the economy of the nation, educating people through college is a very, very good investment. It more than pays for itself.
I wish our state legislature today understood that.
The business. Well, the Constitution says that higher education shall be, quote, as nearly free as possible. That's been reinterpreted a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an aside, but a relevant one.
Yeah, but it also says that the education shall be provided nearly as free as possible, but it doesn't say education, it says instruction. And the focus of that was on the state legislature, not on the university system.
Mm-hmm. So, returning back, 1952.
All right, yeah. It was
the upstart, by the way, is a fellow by the name of Barry Goldwater.
I knew Barry pretty well. I introduced him for 20 years on the Barry Goldwater lecture series we had at the Care Cultural Center in Scottsdale. And he loved to tell stories about the time when in 1950 he went to Howard Pyle, who was a radio personality and a very popular guy.
Subsequently a mayor of Tempe.
No. Governor.
Governor.
Wasn't he mayor of Tempe first?
I don't believe so.
All right. Nope. I stand corrected. I knew he was from Tempe.
So, yeah. He went to Howard Pyle. He said, Howard, you've got to run for governor. And Howard says, I don't have a chance. The Democrats always win. It's a 9-2 advantage. And Barry said, I know you don't have a chance, but we got to put a candidate up there. So Howard ran, and then Barry was his campaign manager. And he carried him to victory over tremendous odds. And two years later.
This is what year?
1950.
50. Okay.
He won against Anna Frohmiller, who was the first woman to run. And she was a very, very astute, adept politician, too, the watchdog of the Treasury. But in 1952, Howard calls Barry in and says, Barry, we've got to run somebody against McFarland. And Barry says, well, there's no chance I could beat him. And Howard says, I know there's no chance, but we've got to run somebody. And Barry loved to tell that story.
And as the rest is history.
Yeah.
And by the way, Barry, among other things, Barry Goldwater defeating Ernest McFarland made room for another major American politician who took over his job as leader of the Senate, a fellow by the name of Lyndon Johnson.
That's right. Yeah.
And so, Lyndon Johnson got it because when Mack was named majority leader, he had to pick a whip.
Yeah.
And he had this, had a lot of potentials. But he liked this young guy from Texas, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Mm-hmm. And so they became lifelong friends for that.
So how did the two of them end up owning television stations?
I can tell you how Mack ended up owning a television station. One of his large interests in the 40s in the Senate, before he was majority leader, was the Interstate Commerce Act. And a piece of that was the FEC. And he also was fascinated by technology. And the single most interesting technology at the time was television, which was in its infancy, of course, in the 40s. So he filed his application very, very early. I don't remember the exact year, but it was before 1953 when KTVK came into being. Mm-hmm. Mack owned half of the station at that time, and he had a really solid investment partners in the other half.
I've often wondered about that. Being a United States senator, I wonder if that didn't help them a little bit with their applications.
It may well, since the guy that filed the application wrote the law that supports the application.
Yeah. Doesn't hurt to have friends in high places. And it's sort of like being an early investor in Google or Amazon. They were certainly investing in the right technology.
Technology.
Yeah.
It was television writ large.
Well, we will pick up in a final segment when we return in the think tank in just a moment. We're talking to Marshall Trimble and Gary Stewart, and stories to come in just a moment in the think tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are here with Marshall Trimble and Gary Stewart, and we're talking Giants of Arizona history. Two of them tangled rather directly and rather nastily in 1952. Incumbent United States Senator Ernest McFarland is taken on by an upstart Phoenix City councilman by the name of Barry Goldwater. That was a dirty election. What was going on?
Well, Barry was really, the odds were really stacked against Barry pretty much.
This is a Democratic state at the time,
sure.
So it was believed.
And we did have a Republican governor now, and this was just the beginning of the two-party Arizona. And Barry was an adventuresome guy. He was handsome. He's charismatic. And he had done this river trip in 1940, 44 days out on the river, photographing it. Then he traveled around Arizona with his taking pictures or showing his films. And he had Stephen Shadegg working with him too as his campaign manager, and he was a pilot. He was a World War II pilot, and he could fly. And he was traveling all over, flying all over Arizona, and he'd made a lot of connections by showing his films in all these little towns. And he was fun. He was a fun guy, young, handsome, like I said, just charismatic. And Mack was busy in Washington. And Mack sort of liked the deal with Ashurst in 1940. Ashurst was overconfident, didn't have time to get out here and campaign. He thought Mack was just a country lawyer. And here now the roles are reversed.
Yeah.
Mack's busy in Washington as majority leader, and I don't think he thought Barry was going to be much of a threat, but he underestimated him.
So wasn't there red baiting in that? Didn't he accuse McFarland of having communist sympathies or something like that?
That was that whole McCarthy period. Yeah,
yeah. In 1952 is actually the middle of that.
Yeah.
It's a nasty – we think we're in a nasty environment right now. That certainly rivaled it.
Yeah.
Well, and the basic fact that Goldwater ran a campaign that was almost identical to Mack's campaign against Ashworth, except for the time difference. And the other thing that Goldwater did was he made sure that he went to everywhere there was to go in Arizona. And Mack was in none of them in that particular campaign. Mack didn't think that he needed to be here that much. He campaigned, so he did come back to Arizona, but not frequently. and he didn't go to the small little towns, and he didn't build up the momentum that Goldwater did. But the big difference from Mack's perspective, at least according to Jim McMullen, was Eugene Pelham, because he lost
the publisher of the newspaper.
That's right. He lost the newspaper. And, of course, Steve Shadegg was his campaign manager.
When did Pulliam take over the paper?
I think it might have been in 50 or 51.
Okay. So it's right just prior to that.
It was just prior to that, yeah. He was a new publisher out here. Mm-hmm. And he was anti, not so much anti-McFarland as he was pro-Goldwater, a very staunch Republican, very deep into the Republican platform that year. And the fascinating thing about the race, the way it turned out, the idea was to move the Senate as far as they could. Well, the Republicans only won one seat in the Senate that year, and it was the one held by the majority leader of the Senate. It's a fascinating reality as a consequence of that campaign.
And the other thing about the Pulliam reference in the Arizona Republic was much more directly and actively involved in politics in this community from there until, I don't know, I'd put it, say, the mid-'80s somewhere, 80s or 90s.
Yes.
They weren't just passive observers. The publisher and the public relations side folks were enmeshed. They had a member of or two on the Phoenix 40.
Yes.
And those kinds of things. And they weren't just observers. They were participants in the political process in this state.
He was against the freeway through the heart of Phoenix, too,
that
put us on about a 20-year behind on that. So Pulliam pulled a lot of weight through that paper, and not nearly as much as the paper does today because we live in different times.
But, what was the objection to the freeways by the paper?
He thought it would separate the city. They had this old thing, we don't want to be like California.
We've had that for a while.
But Pulliam thought that if the freeway went through the heart of Phoenix, where it goes today, mm-hmm. it would separate the two, and form sort of a barrier of this and that, north side, south side.
That proved correct. I mean, there are a lot of towns where they did that. I think of Boston, for example. Now they're finally invented, the big dig solution to that is put the freeway underground. Terry Goddard came up with the Deck Park, which is an attempt to have the freeway, which he originally opposed, but then supported when the necessity got even bigger, but not an elevated freeway, which would have done exactly what, frankly, Goddard and the Pulliam before that said it would do. It does divide neighborhoods if you don't do the architecture correct.
Yeah.
So Ernest McFarland goes on now. He's not done. He's defeated for the center, but he had a trifecta career.
He did. He ran for governor twice. I didn't know it when I started doing this research of the book, but the governor was a 2-year term. So he ran in 52 and then ran again in 54. That took him to 56. Then he ran against Goldwater again in 58. This was another bitter campaign, hard-fought campaign. But clearly Goldwater was the favorite in that campaign, and he won the campaign handily. And as a consequence, Mack now can't be the governor anymore. He can't be in the U.S. Senate anymore, so he ran for the Arizona Supreme Court.
Which was then elected, I believe.
Which was then elected. It was elected until 1972. So he served on the court. And one of the things he's well known for people that don't know the Miranda decision, he's well known for writing the decision in Miranda versus Arizona. He's not well known for the fact that decision was overturned by the United States Supreme Court in its own Miranda versus Arizona decision.
We've had on this show, we've had the arresting officer in here.
Yeah.
It was a decidedly interesting and different point of view on the whole.
Yeah, that's a good story.
There's
a book out on
it
now.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been on a lot of radio interviews with Carol Cooley because I wrote the book on Miranda. And interviewed Carol many times.
Yeah. He has these business cards he passes out with his signature on it. The neat kind of little.
He's a good guy. Carol.
Yeah. And he feels very injured by the way the case has been portrayed. His position, and I think as near as I can tell on it, by the standards of the day, he did everything right.
He did. And so did Ernest McFarland in writing that opinion. It was a correct legal opinion because the opinion that overturned him changed the law.
Mm-hmm. You know, people don't understand that. So maybe you talk about changing the law. I think the high school level of understanding of our government says, well, you know, the legislature passes laws. But then you talk about changing the law and people at the high school level think, well, it's not supposed to do that. But when judges make interpretations of the law, you lawyers refer to that as changing of the law. That doesn't sound right to most people's ears.
Well, we need to call it the common law, which is in fact what it is. Common law is not statutory law, it's case law. Mm-hmm. And more than
in other words, when you have cases that are decided, you evolve the interpretation of what a law means.
And they become precedent for past decisions, for future decisions. But that body of law, the common law, has been made by the judiciary forever. The legislature makes statutory law. They're not involved in common law or case law.
We could do a show on that. We'd love to do it. So, but I promised you each a shot. Yeah. Harry, you want to go first? I said kind of out of your repertoire within the topic, give me your best story. 30 seconds maybe each.
Yeah. Let me give it
now? Yeah, go
okay.
for it.
Mac was asked once, not he didn't do the asking, he did the telling, but one of his law clerks, who's now a famous Arizona lawyer, I'll keep him quiet for the moment, but he was a law clerk for McFarland when he was Chief Justice. And Mac called him into his office one day and he said, "You see those old guys leaving my office a while ago?" He said, "I did." He said, "Well, they're from Florence, and I do favors to these old guys. They're all friends of mine for 50 years, and one of them got a traffic ticket, and I've been fixing his tickets for probably 30 years. I don't have time to do it today. I want you to go fix that ticket." And the young law clerk said, "Your Honor, I can't. I, what are you talking about? I can't fix a ticket." "Oh, hell," he said, "go pay it. Here's the money. Go pay the ticket. I've been doing it for years for him."
Okay, Marshall, you got to be shorter.
That's a good story. Okay. In 1912, a pundit said, I think I got this story from Don Dodaro, but said, that Arizona is now a state. They're a bunch of rascals and mavericks and crazies. And he said, it'll be at least 100 years before they send somebody to Washington that'll make a difference. And we immediately sent Henry Ashurst, Carl Hayden, Ernest McFarland, Barry Goldwater, John Rhodes, Paul Fannin, the Udall brothers, William Rehnquist, Sandra Day O'Connor, and John McCain.
We're running out of time. The list is long. I get the point. Marshall Trimble, Gary Thewer. See you next week in the Think Tank.